translation and purport by His Divine Grace Srila Prabhupada. I also remember the six Goswamis, Rupa Sanatan, Bhattaraganath, Sri Jiva, Gopala Bhatta, and Dasaraganath. Purport. This is the process for writing transcendental literature. A sentimentalist who has no Vaishnava qualification cannot produce transcendental writings. There are many fools who consider Krishna Leela to be a subject of art and write or paint pictures about the pastimes of Lord Krishna with the gopis, sometimes depicting them in a manner practically obscene. These fools take pleasure in material sense gratification, but one who wants to make advancement in spiritual life must scrupulously avoid their literature. Unless one is a servant of Krishna and the Vaishnavas, as Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami presents himself to be in offering respects to Lord Chaitanya, his associates and his disciples, one should not attempt to write transcendental literature. Okay. So, first of all, I'll mention here, you'll see me, there's a bit of shaking going on here. It's not from ecstasy, unfortunately. I have a neurological problem here, so just ignore it. Let's try and concentrate on the talk. I may have to stand up and talk as well, so don't mind. Okay, so here Prabhupada's mentioning about the writing of transcendental literature. I was just reading about a gentleman called John Craig. Craig was a theologian, Christian theologian, who was born in 1663. He was a friend of Sir Isaac Newton, and he was also a mathematician. So he was writing on probability theory, and he made a calculation. He called it the Mathematical Principles of Christianity. It's a small book that he wrote. It's not accepted by so many people, but the principle of it, I think, is sound. Where he made a calculation, according to four principles, about the extent to which a historical figure will be accepted before they pass into the realm of myth, and then nobody believes that they existed anymore. So he calculated that from the life of Lord Jesus, his formula was that according to the number of principal witnesses and then the transmission of their knowledge through secondary witnesses and affected by the passing of time and spatial distance, those were the four criteria, then he calculated that the personality Jesus would be, by the year 3150, completely forgotten, or he would not be at least accepted as a real person. So 3150, that's about 2,000 years short of the 5,000 years that Lord Krishna appeared. And we also see the same business going on, that most people now think that Krishna is just some figment, you know, some mystical, you know, concoction, something to illustrate, you know, particular points of view or whatever. But they don't really believe that Krishna actually existed. Even Gandhi said that if Krishna was a real person, I'll give up my position as a Hindu. So this is a difficulty, of course, you know, Kali Yuga especially, with the passing of time. We lose our touch with events past. And unless there are a number of artifacts, there are a number of witnesses, then depending on how their life and how their works, teachings, etc., are reproduced and passed on, that will decide how long they last. So we don't really have any difficulty. Accepting that Lord Chaitanya existed because it's only 500 years ago. Yeah, although our lives, we're lucky if we live to be 80 or 90. But 500 years ago is not a difficult, you know, gap to bridge. But when you're looking at 5,000 years, then it's a whole different thing. You know, the mind, the consciousness can't really accommodate that kind of length of time. We have no idea what can happen in 5,000 years. It's a long time. So the point is that when a great personality does appear, then it's the duty of his followers to reproduce as exactly as possible his life and teachings, and then pass that on to as many people as possible. And in that way, he remains a reality in human society, at least for some thousands of years, if that can be done. So Srila Prabhupada was very keen on writing, we all know. That was Prabhupada's personal ecstasies, as he said. And it was what he regarded as being his personal service. Creation of ISKCON, of course, was, you know, another personal service. He was inspired and instructed by Krishna how to do that. But Prabhupada's own personal service, if you like, you know, the particular thing that he kept to himself was his commentating, translating and commentating on the Bhagavatam and the Chaitanya Charitamrita. And by faithfully following the previous acharyas, then there's, you know, a good chance that the original works and teachings can be preserved properly and will continue to be effective. So that's Parampara system. Evam Parampara Praptami Mamrajasho Vidu Sakalenihe Mahata Yoganashta Parantapa. Kala, by the passing of time, Krishna says, then Yoganashta, that link with Krishna is lost, and then it has to be reestablished. So at least at the moment, we're very fortunate, as Maharaj was saying yesterday, that we've come only 500 years after the appearance of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. We have a good opportunity to take full advantage. All the teachings are there. And especially beginning from the six Goswamis, they set about that task of writing down the life, and Krishnadas Kaviraj, of course, writing down the life of the Lord and the teachings and inner meanings of what he was saying and doing. Lord Chaitanya himself didn't leave any extant literature, although obviously he could write, but he left the writing to his followers. If we didn't have the writings of the six Goswamis, we would, you know, have no information about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu whatsoever, and the real business of Bhakti Yoga. We would not know how to conduct it. So their main service was wandering around, you know, Braj Dham, was writing, even though they had to live under trees. Or they by choice lived under trees, etc. They didn't keep any fixed up places of residence, but still they were able to write voluminous amounts of nectar about Lord Chaitanya and about his teachings, the Chinchabeda Beda Tattva, and expand that very effectively to their followers. And over the years that's been continued. But even then we see so many deviations from the original thought and practice. By the time of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Vaishnavism was considered to be very low class. It was practically, the real meaning of it was practically lost to the general population, although you'll see that in Bengal, wherever you travel, people still, even if they're Shaktas or whatever, but still Gaudiya Vaishnavism is very strongly practiced in many places, but as a matter of tradition, not really as a matter of realization. And therefore, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he himself had to sit down and write over 100 books about Gaudiya Vaishnavism to restore the real meaning and the, you know, verify the real events as they happened. And to do that, he had to try to find the Chaitanya Charitamrita. He'd heard about it, but it took him several years before he was able to secure an authentic copy of it. This is in Bengal. So things deteriorate quite quickly And if work is not done to preserve and restore those teachings, then in a very short period of time, it's all gone. People get, or even if they have some memory or they think they know something, but if there's a lack of authentic literature, there's nothing to verify their thoughts against. And therefore, all kinds of mental concoctions creep in, material desires mix with spiritual aspiration, and then you get all kinds of deviant behavior coming out in the name of real spiritual life. So writing transcendental literature is one of the most important things that any devotee can do, because it gives a chance, at least, for the events and teachings to continue on in human society for hundreds, maybe even thousands of years. Yeah. Again, you take the Veda. The Veda is there. It's timeless in one sense. But when the British scholars, European scholars came into India, they started reading the Veda. They thought this is amazing literature. But according to their own concoction, they assigned, you know, a time frame for it, which was less than that of the appearance of Jesus, so that they could claim. But because for them, it was inconceivable that there could be any, you know, worthy religious literature before the appearance of Christ. He was the one that really taught the way. And therefore, when they read the Vedic literature and started translating it, like William Jones, Sir William Jones, he did most of his works, translation works of the Vedas, in the latter part of the 1700s. He died in 1795. He was a brilliant scholar. He knew 14 languages fluently. He knew 26 other languages conversantly. So that's 40 languages. So he was a brilliant scholar on that level. But when he read about, you know, the appearance of Krishna, and he looked at the historicity of the Vedas, he could not accept that they could have come about before 2000. Before 2000 years ago. In other words, that they predated Christ. He couldn't accept it. So he reinterpreted it so that it made that the Vedas were actually only about 1,000 years old, or at the most 1,400 years. And that became, because he was such a good scholar, although it was pure speculation, not based on any facts whatsoever, that became, you know, circulated amongst the scholars, and then that became the new established history of India. They just came in and rewrote the history of India according to their own, you know, fancy and speculation, being motivated, you know, by a particular ideology. So these things are going on all the time. You get this twisting and warping, and then what comes as a result is a complete confusion. Yeah, people then they start to look at later scholars come. They start to look at Vedic literature, but they use as a marker William Jones or Charles Wilkins. He was the first one who translated the Bhagavad Gita into English and put it into print in 1785. Well, we have a third print of his Bhagavad Gita in our Bhaktivedanta Research Center in Calcutta from 1840, I think it is. It was a third print. So, you know, it's in one sense a laudable attempt. They found something that they'd never seen before in Vedic literature. No culture in the world has such extensive descriptions and deep esoteric meanings as what is provided by the Veda. But at the same time, you know, they have their own motivation, their own justifications for doing what they did, and they've spoiled the whole thing. One of Srila Prabhupada's main, you know, complaints, which regularly he preached on, was the distortion of Bhagavad Gita. We went to a Gita Pratishthan, a Gita Foundation meeting at the end of 1976 in Wardha, in India. And Prabhupada's main point there, he did this He wrote up a script, if you like, for ready for a meeting with this gentleman called Vinoba Bhave, who was the kind of inspiration behind this meeting. There was, I think, about 23 different points that Prabhupada... It was like a questions and answers thing. Prabhupada would pose a question, and then he would answer the question himself with a verse and purport, his purport, from Bhagavad Gita as it is. So he prepared this whole sheet. He went to this meeting, and they had one day's meetings, like workshops. Then the next day, they called Srila Prabhupada to come and attend the meeting. They presented to him what they thought was a good plan for popularizing or repopularizing Bhagavad Gita in Indian society. Their concern was good. They thought that things were becoming too materialistic, people were being diverted from their original culture, and they should do something to, you know, revive it or sustain it, carry it forward. And so they came up with these different ideas, you know, about having like a Bhagavad Gita essay day in all the schools. So all over India, you know, the children should write an essay on the Bhagavad Gita. They should have some pravachan, you know, some pandals here and there, etc., etc. So when they read that out to Srila Prabhupada, he immediately, you know, he was already primed, actually, because he knew that everybody in the room were Mayavadis. So he wasn't looking forward to mixing with them. But when he sat down in the meeting, I saw immediately he sat up straight. And if Prabhupada did that, then you knew that he was agitated. He was, he would get tense. If he got angry, one of the first symptoms of that would be that he would sit bolt straight upright. And then his top lip would start quivering and his face would flush. And then he would start hammering. So he did that in a kind of a muted way, because the people that had organized the meeting, they were kind of innocent people. Ramakrishna Bajaj, he was the owner of Bajaj Industries. You know, they make the scooters and electrical fans and all those kinds of things. So that man... he was an organizer. His brother-in-law was Sriman Narayan, who himself was a prolific author on the life of Gandhi, and he had been the first chief minister of Gujarat. So they were there. So Prabhupada kind of kept it a bit muted. But he just got into them and explained to them. He told them, he said, you cannot spread the Bhagavad Gita if you don't know what the Bhagavad Gita is. Unless you accept the Bhagavad Gita in the way that Arjuna accepted it, then all your talk will be useless. So he kept going on and on, that you cannot reinterpret or misinterpret Bhagavad Gita. So when he said that, then one man who was, you know, immediately some of them became a bit agitated, because Prabhupada was telling them that you don't know what you're talking about. So they didn't take well to that. And this man said, well, you know, any interpretation is bound to have some, you know, discrepancy. You can't perfectly interpret it. So Prabhupada told him, if you don't know how to interpret, then don't do it. That's all. So he said, well, yours is also an interpretation. So Prabhupada shot back and he said, it's not an interpretation, it is a presentation. And then the guy said, well, that's the same thing. And somebody else said, no, he's actually, there's a difference. So Prabhupada was presenting the Bhagavad Gita as it is. He was careful to name it very clearly that this is the authentic version. These other gentlemen, they had their own versions, just as Gandhi did. You know, we were there in the heartland of Gandhiism. Just a few miles away was the Gandhi ashram at Sevagram. And this Vinoba Bhave, he had his Pona ashram. And Wardha was the place where Gandhi used to meet with all of his associates when they were plotting how to get rid of the British from India. So it was kind of saturated in Gandhi lore. And, you know, we had an opportunity to visit the Gandhi ashram. That was part of our stay there. That Bajaj and Sriman Narayan took us around on a personal tour. So we had a look around, and then on dusk, Then everybody came out into an open air prayer area and sat down, and they put Gandhi's seat in the front. And then they started chanting some mantras from Bhagavad Gita, something from the Bible, something from the Torah and the Koran and the Zoroastrian and the this and the that. The whole thing took about half an hour. And it sounded a bit, to me, like a kind of a funeral march. It's very somber and, you know. But this was their idea of preserving things. But unfortunately, you know, as Prabhupada noted when we left, there was not one single picture of Krishna in the whole place. There was not one single deity of Krishna in the whole place, although they're supposed to be based on the Bhagavad Gita. And of course, Gandhi's interpretation of the Gita, you know, that the body is the Kurukshetra and the five senses of the Pandavas and blah, blah, blah. And how to screw out non-violence from a book which is all about killing people. You know, so, but, you know, people have no discrimination anymore. And in fact, in India, when you mention Bhagavad Gita, people don't think there is a meaning. They don't think that there is an actual original meaning to it, that it's meant to be speculated about, and that's the glory of the Bhagavad Gita, that it agitates your brain and stimulates speculation and, you know, produces all kinds of fanciful, wonderful thoughts. They actually think that that's what its purpose is. So the real meaning has been completely lost. It's been, you know, misrepresented by so many rascals. So Prabhupada's mission was to try to rectify, you know, that misrepresentation. So he didn't mind sitting in the middle of this meeting and letting them know that they were all off. Even if it meant that, you know, they became agitated with them. One young lady at the back, I think she was from the TMers, she started calling out, "Why should we accept Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's version?" Prabhupada snapped back. He said, I haven't said anything about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. I say Arjuna's version, Krishna's version," like that. So it's always a task. It's a hard work to preserve the original culture, the original teachings, the original stories and narrations, the leelas. Time is such that, you know, it moves things very quickly. Kali Yuga people have very dim memories. Things are lost very quickly. We can't even remember what we did this time, you know, last week. What to speak about hundreds of years or thousands of years, etc. So some method of preservation has to be there. Nobody's a Shrutidar. Yeah. In previous ages, they would hear something once and remember it. That was it. It was etched in their brains. Then they would meditate on it and so slowly, slowly, you know, get the meaning. But in Kali Yuga, there was a need for writing things down. Transmission of knowledge is done through literature as in its most effective way. Word of mouth now is secondary, simply because people can't exactly remember things and they can't reproduce them properly. But if you write it down, then at least, you know, the form of it is there. Then, of course, you know, the other side of that is that it must be understood through the agency of purified souls. You know, primary sources, secondary sources. But they must be purified. They must be able to understand the real meaning of the text. It's not enough just to preserve the text, but then it's also got to be transmitted in the true spirit of it as well. So, therefore, as Prabhupada said, writing literature, publishing literature, this is our Vaishnava family business. Yeah, this is what we're all about, and this is why Prabhupada very strenuously stress the distribution of his books, because these are not ordinary books. These books actually bring a person in contact with Krishna, because Krishna is not a historical figure. There's no history for Krishna. Krishna is ever present, Navayavana. He's eternal. He's as present now as he was 5,000 years ago. But we're separated, yeah, by the veil of the material energy. And that curtain has to be drawn back. So the Vaishnavas, the representatives of Krishna, That's their business, to draw back the veil, penetrate the text, and explain the true meaning and bring Krishna out from the pages. When Prabhupada was in France in 1976, there was one professor that came to see him, Francois Chanique. He'd written a nice review of Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita Tel Calais, and just a couple of days before we went to France, we were here at the manor, and Prabhupada was presented with the new French Bhagavatam. It was the first print of the first volume of the first canto. So that was given to Prabhupada. Prabhupada was very, very happy to see that. He made a comment. He said that when a book comes out, my Guru Maharaj is very pleased. Not was, is. So this was shown to Francois Chanique. He came and had a nice darshan with Prabhupada. He was very polite and sincere man. He was a big professor, well respected. And he told Prabhupada that he would like to see, you know, Prabhupada's Bhagavatam in use in all the colleges and universities in France, because they only had one other French version from the 1800s, and that had no commentary. So because it had no commentary, then, you know, obviously it's difficult to penetrate for somebody that is not aware of the, you know, Vaishnava thought and practice. So he was welcoming Prabhupada's, you know, presentation of it, although he expressed some doubt, you know, that because the French version was a direct translation from the English, then therefore grammatically sometimes it was not exactly correct. And the French, he said, there should not be a smell of English. That was the phrase that he used. So in our books, there should be no smell of English, because the French, of course, they're very particular about their language. So Prabhupada said, that's all right, but so far, no. The professor suggested that we should translate directly from the Sanskrit into French. So Prabhupada said, that's all right. If there's some mistakes, that can be corrected later on. But he said, the fact is that so far we don't have any devotees that, you know, are Sanskritists. And even then, that's not the issue. The real issue is that you have to hear the Bhagavatam from a self-realized soul. Then you'll understand it. He said, there's many Sanskrit scholars in India, but they cannot understand the Bhagavatam. He said, if you translate the words one by one, Janma Jasya Jata, you can give some explanation. That's not a difficult thing, to translate, you know, the words Sanskrit into French or Sanskrit into English or whatever. But to understand and penetrate the meaning, that can only be done by a devotee. It can only be done by a self-realized soul. Otherwise, anybody else that attempts it, they'll simply be baffled. It won't make any sense to them whatsoever. So it's what we call an open secret. It sounds like an oxymoron. If something is a secret, then how can it be open? If something's open, how can it be a secret? But that's Bhagavad Gita, that's transcendental literature. Yeah, the spiritual world is there. It's always there, but we don't see it. Yeah, we only see this material world. We get clouded by the modes of material nature. And although the spiritual world is there, consciousness is there, the soul is there, we don't see any of these things. We're bewildered by such ideas. People become atheists because they have no realization, even though they themselves are transcendental living beings. But they deny the reality of transcendental life because their consciousness is shrouded. It's covered over by the modes of material nature. So the work of the acharyas is to remove that covering, to open up the curtain, and to give us a glimpse of who we truly are, who Krishna is, what the spiritual world is, and what reality is. This is the whole purpose. It's para upakara, it's to do good for others. So Prabhupada made that point very strongly many, many times, that misinterpretations, deviations, you know, misrepresentations, this is actually damaging human society very badly. There's a hope that when we come to human life, we have now a chance to solve all our problems. Human beings have a little intelligence, or a little extra intelligence. The animals get the intelligence to eat, sleep, mate, and defend. But human beings have some intelligence beyond that, and that's meant to be applied to solving the problems of life. And if we can't solve our problems of life, then how we can say we're intelligent? Yeah, we don't have. So therefore, Bhagavad Gita is Buddha Yoga. Yeah, the highest intelligence is required in order to understand it. Or rather, it restores to us real intelligence, yeah, knowledge of reality. So in that way, then Prabhupada was presenting Bhagavad Gita as it is, and opening up the door to the spiritual world for us, as he says here. Fools take pleasure in material sense gratification. So they take, you know, transcendental literature as just another tool for enjoyment, that's all. I was in Calcutta some years ago. Our daughter was in hospital. And so there was one other little girl in the ward. The parents were coming every night, so we got chit-chatting. And I was talking with this man. And then he said, I read Bhagavad Gita every day. He said, it's my favorite literature. So I thought, wow, this guy's a bhakta. But then when I asked him about, so what do you think about where Krishna says that you should surrender to him? He said, why should I surrender to Krishna? Why should he have all the fun? That was his response. Now, this man is reading Bhagavad Gita every day. But he said, I said, well, why do you read it then? He said, no, it makes, you know, stimulates my brain. Yeah, I like to speculate and come out with new meanings. This was his idea. Why should I surrender to Krishna? Why should he have all the fun? I want to enjoy. He actually said it. I want to enjoy. So he's reading Bhagavad Gita, but he's not getting anywhere with it. He has no idea. So people don't like to hear things as they are. It's a tough job, especially in Kali Yuga. Everybody's so motivated, so foolish, less intelligent. And the end result is that, you know, the life in the material world continues on and on, birth after birth. And their intelligence is lost. There's no practical result from them having, you know, this higher intelligence, because they're not solving the real problems. The real problems are not eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. The real problems are birth, death, disease, and old age, and how to get out of it. So the acharyas, then, they're very concerned to do good for others. And the main vehicle that they use is the writings. Yeah, these books are very important. Chaitanya Charitamrita is one of the few literatures that we have on the life of Lord Chaitanya. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati said that actually there were many biographies of Lord Chaitanya written by different followers, but most of them have been lost, or almost all of them have been lost. And that's actually a great calamity for the whole world, that these literatures are not there. But at least we have the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Chaitanya Bhagwat, and a few other smaller works. So these things must be preserved. If they're not preserved, if they're not passed on from generation to generation, very, very quickly the whole thing becomes spoiled and lost, as it was during Bhaktivinoda Thakur's time. He single-handedly revived the whole understanding of it, the philosophy of Achintya Bheda Bheda Tattva. Other than that, practically without his efforts, what was there? So many different apasampradayas that he listed, malpractices that they were doing, all in the name of so-called bhakti or devotion. So he revived or restored the tarnished image of the Vaishnav culture and teachings. And we have a great responsibility to pass that on. That was one of our main motivations, of course, in setting up this Bhaktivedanta Research Center in Calcutta. I'm sure many of you have heard of that by now. This afternoon I'll be showing an updated PowerPoint on the latest happenings there. Just as an example, at the beginning of this year we had a visit from a gentleman called Swarup Mitra. And he's from a very aristocratic old family. in Calcutta, the Suramitra family. He showed me they have a volume this thick, like this, with all their ancestry. What they call it? The family trees. Huh? Genealogy. Thank you. That was the word. He's got their aristocratic family, so they have their entire genealogy, just like you find in the Bhagavatam, you know. So-and-so was the son of this one, and he was the son of that one. And so they have the whole thing in a book this thick. Their history goes back at least 250 years ago. They were a wealthy to-do family in Ayodhya, and they were worshippers of Rivati Balaram. Apparently in Ayodhya, there's some area there where they worship Rivati Balaram. So Pitamba Mitra was awarded the title Raja. But then sometime after, the Muslims came and drove them out. So they went to Mathura. Then they got driven out from Mathura by the Muslims and the British. And they ended up in Calcutta about 250 years ago. So one of his descendants... what was his name? Rajendralal Mitra. He was the first Indian president of the Asiatic Society. The Asiatic Society was co-founded by William Jones. He was also the librarian there for 30 years, this Rajendralal Mitra. That was like in the 1850s through to the 1880s. So that family, they know the value of the literature. Yeah, they had many, many Vaishnava manuscripts. They've got their own library. But this man that came to see us, he's a descendant, Swarup Mitra, he invited us, after he saw what we were doing in the library, he invited us to come to their house. They had one of these big old 200-year-old colonial houses for joint family. Now not only the mother lives in there. But they have a nice temple, Rivati Balaram. The original deities from Ayodhya has still been worshipped very nicely. So these are people that know the value, you know, of literature. Their, you know, ancestor was the librarian of the Asiatic Society. But when we went there, he showed us all these manuscripts that they have. That was why he contacted us, because they don't know what to do with them. Many of them written on handmade paper, stacked up in bundles and all, you know, literally under inches of dust. And they know they're valuable, but they don't know what to do with them. They have no direction, no help. So they asked us to come help them clean them up. And then we were able to photograph about 80 of the manuscripts. So some thousands and thousands of pages, extensive, but these are all Vaishnava literatures. Now, this is a family that knows the value of it. Now, what to speak about places where they don't know the value or they've lost the sense of that? There are many places all over Bengal. In Bangladesh, we found a place there, 9,000 manuscripts just heaped on shelves, not sorted, no list. No catalogue, nobody knows what's in them, they're just rotting away in the Nabadweep Town Library. It used to be the Edward VII Anglo-Sanskrit Library from 1907. This is just across the river in Nabadweep. And now what do they want to do? Previously they had scholars coming visiting. They had a very extensive 2,500 manuscripts, very valuable stuff. Scholars would come and study there. Now nobody goes there. The manuscripts are all locked up in metal almirahs in 120 degree heat. You know, they locked away in some room upstairs. It's like a furnace in there. And we looked inside the cabinets. They allowed us to see what they got. And they're all brown and curled up and rotting away. Some of them have been looked after, but many of the others are not. So this is a public library. Now they call themselves the Nabadweep Public Library because they want all the school kids to come and play on the computers that they've got. So nobody has any interest in the manuscripts anymore. And they don't even know what they've got. This is the public library. They have no catalogue of the manuscripts. So they asked us to come there, Pranava Prabhu, and make a proper catalogue, and they've indicated that if there's anything that we want, they're willing to sit down, you know, and bargain. So we may be able to buy a few things. But this is the public libraries, what to speak about anywhere, you know, private collections. So people very, you know, rapidly lose the sense of value of what they have. You know, there's always this pressure to move on, do the next big thing, you know. Now it's all electronics and, you know, iPads and iPhones and whatever. But therefore they see there's no value to these old manuscripts. But actually, if you lose all of that, you're losing touch with the past. You're losing touch with your roots. And in another generation or so, it'll all be finished, forgotten, gone. So one of our endeavors with the research center is we go out and we look for old manuscripts and try to preserve them. It doesn't matter whether they're 100, 200, 300, or 400 years old. Even if they're the same literature that you find in many different places, but each version that is there, it becomes part of, you know, the provenance, the ability to trace back a literature to its origin, so that you can check and see that it's an accurate reproduction. It's very important that one has to be able to do that. Otherwise, as they get copied and recopied and passed on, mistakes may be made, something may get missed out, something may get added in. So if you have a provenance, you have an ability to trace back the literature to its origin, which in our case, of course, with Gaudiya Vaishnava literature, would mean to the six Goswamis and then their followers, or Baladev Vijayabhushan, etc., Krishnadas Kaviraj. Unless you've got that ability to do that, then it becomes a question after some time whether what the versions that you have are actually accurate or not. You know, there are many different versions of the Mahabharata now. Prabhupada was asked one time by Jadarani, well, is there an authorized version of the Mahabharata that we can refer to? And Prabhupada wrote back and said, no. I mean, what's there is pretty well accurate, but there's a lot of, you know, extra verses here and there, depending on the version that you read. So it's very, very, it's a big responsibility. Prabhupada himself said when, you know, we were looking at the literature that's in Biyanaga, the birthplace of Bhaktivinoda Thakur, last year they allowed us to come there and catalogue all the literature that they have. We were then able to bring it all to the library and scan it all. So there's about 25 original works of Bhaktivinoda Thakur. There's a whole bunch of stuff by Lalit Prasad Thakur, his son, and various other authors, and they're just literally rotting away. They know it's important, they know they're valuable, but they don't know what to do with them and how to look after them. So we're working with them very closely now to help, you know, scan and then preserve the originals. And Prabhupada said this, they must be preserved for future generations to see the actual handwriting of such great saintly persons. Why is it important? Because in the future, somebody may present something and say, this is Bhaktivinoda Thakur's work, and it may not be. Yeah. So you want to be able to trace it back and see whether it really is, there is an original version. And the less artifacts that there are coming from, you know, a historical personality, the more likelihood that that person will be eventually forgotten. Then it just becomes stories. And stories, you know, I've had personal experience sometimes with devotees coming in to talk to Srila Prabhupada about a particular topic. And because they have some, you know, particular personal interest in, you know, understanding an event or a point of philosophy in a particular way, even though when they sat down and talked with Prabhupada and discussed it, and Prabhupada did not support their idea but corrected them, when they came out of the room, they still had the same idea. And they actually, at least in one case I know, they actually thought that Prabhupada had just confirmed what they were thinking. When I was in the room and I was listening to the whole thing, and I saw that Prabhupada said just the opposite. But, you know, that filtration in the brain there, you know, the way that you perceive things, the way that you hear things. So even direct perception, yeah, first class, you know, first-hand contact is not necessarily always reliable. So you have to write things down and get them clear, and then you pass them on. And the more secondary sources, and the more effective the transmission is through the secondary sources from the original sources, then the more chance there is that it will last and continue on, you know, guiding human society. So, you know, these are a few points here. There is a process of writing transcendental literature. You have to be the servant of the previous acharyas. You have to be empowered by them, because that's another feature of writing, is that one should actually be pure, and therefore you can get inspiration from Krishna himself as well. Just like Srila Prabhupada, when he was living in the Radha Damodar Mandir in this first half of the 60s, we know that several times he actually was visited by his spiritual master and instructed how to write the Bhagavatam. And also he was visited by Rupa, Sanatan and Jiva Goswamis. They appeared to him and personally instructed him how to write his purports and how to prepare for going to the West for his future preaching mission. So that inner, you know, inspiration, purity, clarity has to also be there. But even if one is not so pure, but if he faithfully copies what's been passed on, yeah, if he accurately represents it, then it will still continue on and continue to be effective. So that's our job, really, is that we're just the servants. We're not writing in order to get name and fame for ourselves. We're just writing in order to represent accurately what has been, or what has come originally from the appearance of the Lord himself. I was just reading this morning an interesting comment. You know, in the 70s, there was this phenomena of deprogramming groups of people that were against the devotees or against any religious group, really, and capturing, you know, devotees and trying to, as they say, deprogram them, because the idea was that we were all brainwashed, yeah, and so we had to be deprogrammed and brought back to being normal, meat-eating, fornicating, intoxicators. That was their idea. So one of their arguments to try and convince, you know, a devotee to give up their affiliation with ISKCON was that there's so many books by this one man in such a short period of time, it's impossible. Right? It could not be true. Therefore, you're being tricked. This is not his work. It must be somebody else. This is all a conspiracy. But it's not possible for one man to have written so much in such a short period of time. So what we see is a huge plus. You know, Prabhupada writing 80 volumes of books on the most, you know, difficult, deep penetration of ideas and thought. You know, he did it because he was empowered to do it, because he was a humble servant. He was able to do it because he was empowered that way. So if one is a servant of the acharyas, then you can write. That's the point that's being made here, Krishnadas Kaviraj. You know, he decries his own ability, but he says that whatever I can do is by the mercy of Rupa, Sanatan, Bhatta Raghunath, Sri Jiva, Gopala Bhatta, Dasa Raghunath. Therefore, each chapter opens up with the glorification of the devotees. Because without the mercy of the devotees, without being empowered by them, nobody can actually write or transmit transcendental knowledge. So anyway, this is our ISKCON movement. Just like Prabhupada, you know, he did his translation and commentary on the Chaitanya Charitamrita, the entire 17 volumes, he did it in 18 months. Yeah, it's inconceivable. We were in Toronto, one professor came, a group of professors. But, you know, the Chaitanya Charitamrita had just come out the year before. The Library Party was traveling all over America and convincing all the professors to order them for their university libraries. So they were astonished how this could be done. This man is traveling all over the world constantly. He's got this whole worldwide movement. He is the movement. They all knew that. Everything that we were doing was just simply whatever Prabhupada said and decided upon and was showing the example for. So they knew, I mean, Prabhupada, just to do that was an impossibility almost when you're over 70 years old. But then apart from that, the man is writing like anything. You know, this Chaitanya Charitamrita suddenly appears, you know, in 1 year or 1.5 years, the entire thing. And there was one professor, Dimmock. Well, anyway, the ones that came to Toronto. So that was the question. Where do you find the time to write? And Prabhupada said, well, you know, I go to bed at 10:30. I get up at 12:30. I finish the balance of my rounds, if there's any left. And then I write in the night. He said, little drops of water wear away a stone. And the Library Party, they actually went to one university where this Professor Dimmock was teaching. Dimmock was considered to be the leading authority on Chaitanya Vaishnavism in America, at least until Prabhupada came on the scene. He would frequently fly to Vrindavan. He would go through the original works of the six Goswamis. But as Sasrup informed Prabhupada, practically everything that the man wrote was blasphemous, because he was interpreting it according to his own, you know, sets of values and perceptions of things, and he could not understand what it was that he was translating. But he knew Sanskrit very well, and Bengali. And apparently, anyway, his, what is that, magnus opus, his life's work, was to do the first English translation of the Chaitanya Charitamrita. And he'd been working on it for years. I mean, literally years and years. And he got like one volume or something. And then the devotees walk in one day and they say, would you like to order our spiritual master's books? Bang. Chaitanya Charitamrita complete. 17 volumes. You know, word for word, transliteration, translation, commentary, you know, paintings, photographs, the whole thing. They said he practically had a heart attack. Because what he'd struggled to do for many years, and this man was a professor, Prabhupada just, boom, 1.5 years, the whole thing out. And apart from that, you know, the Bhagavatam's coming out, all the individual books are coming out, Krishna and TLC and Nectar of Devotion, Nectar of Instruction. It's phenomenal. Yeah, as Prabhupada himself said, that, you know, an ordinary human being cannot do this. He ascribed it to Krishna himself, that, you know, he's just a mouthpiece and Krishna was speaking through him. But it's possible. Anyway, the point is that transcendental literature is very, very important. We have to preserve it. We have to make sure that we shouldn't take it for granted that just right now, you know, everything's available, that it's always going to be like this. When Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was on the planet, you know, his followers were writing. But of course, they didn't have the reproduction methods that we can take advantage of now. There were no printing presses. It was all handwritten. But it was being copied and passed along. But within, you know, 100 years, 200 years, the real understanding of it was all warped and distorted. So we shouldn't think, you know, that just because right now we're in a situation where everything is okay, you know, that it's always going to be like this. We have to make the endeavor to preserve this literature, as Prabhupada said, forever, so that future generations can see the actual handwriting of these saintly persons. Then they'll believe that they exist, or at least there's a better chance that they'll believe that they exist if their original handwritings are available. If they're not, then, you know, after a short period of time, oh, well, maybe he said that, maybe he didn't. Yeah, no, I don't believe any such person existed. This is Kali Yuga. People have short memories. Manda Samanda Mateo, Manda Bhaga, Bhagya, Upadrata. Even if people are a little sincere in the midst of all the, you know, crippling deficiencies of being in Kali Yuga, still Mandabhagya, their fortune is spoiled. Instead of coming in contact with somebody genuine, they meet so many cheaters and charlatans and false gurus and, you know, Mayavadis and rascals, so-called Vedantists. So people, you know, lose the opportunity of their human life. So Prabhupada was very keen then that we write. He, right from the beginning, when as soon as he came to New York, 1966, he started getting a little bit of a following. The very first thing that he did was he gave them the Back to Godhead magazine, which had been his main preaching tool in the 1950s. He handed that to his disciples. He said, now you write your realizations, you know, put it into print and distribute this magazine. So it's a family tradition, and we should all be interested in recording, you know, the histories of this movement. It's very important, just as we have all the stories of Lord Chaitanya and his followers, people in the future will be reading all the stories about Srila Prabhupada and his followers. It's natural. So they have to be very carefully preserved. And writing is the best way to do that. Yeah, and the printed word is, you know, at least more durable. Right now we have the ability to, you know, put things on the web, on the internet. You can spread it all over the world very quickly. But it's very kind of ephemeral. Yeah, all the text, and you can write so many things. You know, press a button on your computer by accident and it all disappears. I've had that experience. I spent so many hours and days writing, I hit the wrong button and deleted the whole lot. So, you know, everything nowadays, we have the, you know, the international, you know, internet. But actually all of that depends on, you know, various kinds of hardware, technology. That technology is changing every 5 or 10 years. You have to keep on updating. This is one of the problems that they have in libraries now, is that they've been putting everything, you know, into an electronic medium. But every 5 or 10 years, all the software that runs it, you know, that utilizes that data, is changed. So they have to spend millions of dollars every few years to update all the hardware and all the software just to keep, you know, the information out there. And at any moment, you know, the whole thing can collapse. There's in New York, there's a whole skyscraper building. There's nothing but computer servers in it. That's all there is. It's one of the main hubs for the internet, for the whole world. Now, and that building's not that far away from, you know, the World Trade Centers. You know, it didn't miss it by much. But you can imagine what would happen if somebody blew up that building. You know, all the data that would be lost, just boom, finished. So, you know, at least I personally feel that printed word, you know, good solid books, these are the things that will carry the message forward and, you know, keep things proper. Okay, anyway, it's 9 o'clock, so we'll finish at this point. Does anybody have any comments or questions?